welcome to episode 19 of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And in this episode, we welcome the return of Dave Hall, whose company we haven't enjoyed since way back when in episode 8. Much of the stuff we catch up on this time is related to Dave settling into his new role as University Secretary at the Open University, the challenges of his changing job during lockdown, and the distinctive mission of his new employer, which he's now nearly learned all about. But also his pleasure at discovering he will actually have a campus to work on in due course. Dave discloses the surprising news that he's actually developed a new level of basic IT competence, which has come in extremely useful in engaging remotely with his colleagues from all over the UK across the OU's operations. Dave and I also discuss the challenges facing our sector in the context of changing government moods and set against the broad sweep of higher education history. And also the view from some quarters that all universities are trying to do is grow a load of mini Che Guevaras. It's good to have him back. Do enjoy. Welcome, everyone. And it's a really enormous pleasure to welcome back Dave Hall. It's been a long time since Dave and I had a conversation. You recall we had quite a few conversations at the beginning of this exciting series of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And indeed, you know, the first series of episodes was me and Dave talking about stuff. So Dave's been very, very, very busy, which is why he hasn't been able to talk to me for the past 6 months. So in the meantime, I've obviously been talking to other people who weren't Dave. But let's talk a wee bit, Dave, if we can. And welcome back, by the way. It's been I've really missed you, as I'm sure of all of your fans. But you've started a new job, and I think that's been a very good reason for being a bit busy. So do you want to tell us what you've done in terms of moving from Leicester to your new role?
Yeah, thanks, Paul, and thanks for the thoughtful introduction. And I hope you've enjoyed yourself with different people every week. But it's nice to be back and shooting the breeze with you about things. Yeah, it's been both fascinating and traumatic at the same time, obviously starting a new job, because I guess it depends how often you start a new job as to how traumatic it is. But I'd been at Leicester and enjoyed many happy years there, but 13 is a long time to spend somewhere and then step off to somewhere new. But that's partly why I did want to move. You can come a bit stale, and I remember someone saying to me once, you've got to beware of the time when you become part of the problem. So I was worried about that for about 8 years that I was at Leicester, 8 of the 13.
Yes.
So with that in mind, obviously many jobs and opportunities had come and gone. So I moved to the OU in March, and one of the first things I had to do was on the Sunday, after I'd been there in the office for about 4 days, was to decide that we comply with government legislation and lock down the institution and therefore go directly home. And all I'd managed to do in my office was replace the waste paper bin, because I felt it was critical that I had something that was large enough to cope with all my failings. So that was all I'd done in the office and met a few colleagues. But on reflection about starting a new job more generally, obviously there's an advantage if you can carry with you some, you're going somewhere where there's something that's similar, but you know, something to hang on to almost, you know, and that was one advantage of the OU. Obviously it's another university, but it was also sufficiently different to be exciting. And I don't know whether it, but I think it was reassuring to see that some of the problems and challenges were the same. I mean, you might say, well, that's a bit depressing if it's all the same. Well, no, it was knowing I could, I had some idea of how I might deal with them and how I would work with colleagues was an advantage. And then at the same time, ironically, not of course knowing anything about the way the organisation worked. And the other critical difference is the language is different.
So what, they speak French?
Well, that would have been a real blow, obviously. There was no way I was going to be able to cope, which is why I'm still living in the UK. But we talk about things in different, we use different, what do you call it, different shorthand for things. But, you know, I've been years talking about student recruitment and, you know, the September intake and registration, what have you. And colleagues at the OU talk about 20J, which is, I thought, was a form that we were in. You know, we were all in 20J. But that 20 is the year, obviously. And J,
yes,
obviously, is the month of September, if you were paying attention. So
they use a different calendar from the rest of the world. They're still on the Roman calendar or whatever it is.
Yeah, so the months are named after letters of the alphabet.
And there's a logic to that which escapes me, but I guess it keeps things spicy and interesting, and also excludes new members of staff from knowing what the heck is going on.
So it's an example of the language being initially a barrier. I mean, I've hopefully picked it up now. What we mean by, you know, 21B, as you probably already twigged, is next February.
February, yes. Yeah.
so that there is a way of, you can translate it quickly. And also, I was a bit disturbed to know we had large conflations, and I wasn't sure. Again, you know, not being of a medical persuasion, I could help
straight to the health centre.
But apparently that's we would call them examination or assessment periods. Once you know that. So it's that difference and similarity is both gives you the reassurance or the comfort, as well as then the challenge and the interest.
So, but you moved there just before lockdown. And I suppose, you know, thinking about the OU from a position of near but not quite complete ignorance, I would imagine that there is no university, you know, more capable of adapting to that new environment that everyone else was forced to adapt to post-lockdown than the OU. I mean, did it switch seamlessly into business in a way that the rest of us struggled with, having, you know, barely used Teams or Zoom before the 23rd of March?
Yes. And I would obviously not ever say no to that question. But yes, funnily enough, it came as a surprise to me when I was visiting the OU that it's got a campus the size of a university already. And a beautiful, beautiful campus, nicely positioned in Milton Keynes, as well as sites across the UK, obviously in Edinburgh, Cardiff and Belfast, a site in Dublin, and an outfit near you in Nottingham. And
indeed, yeah.
And offices in Manchester and a warehouse in Wellingborough. So I haven't yet been able to visit all those places, but I've certainly been to Manchester, Nottingham and Wellingborough. So it's a very much a UK-wide university. Operating across the four nations, and that's another big difference that influenced my learning as soon as I got there. You know, and I've already fallen into the trap of thinking of a campus in Milton Keynes as opposed to four or five sites across the UK. And so the in terms of how ready we were, yeah, obviously we got more students than anybody else. So I think it's about 70,000 students or something like that, none of whom thankfully are on campus. Postgraduate research students, I think there's about 900 of them, so they're obviously affected. And we also have 4,000 associate tutors, and these are the kind of front line of the OU, who the students will come in to interact with to get tutorial support, and they all work from home and always have done.
Right.
So that's about half the population.
So in terms of academic delivery, that's normal business then?
Yeah, academic delivery, of course, is the teaching is done through the online materials, yeah. and or other materials delivered, whether they're hard copy or online. So the teaching, interestingly, is embedded in the learning materials. So the learning materials do the teaching. So you don't need a tutor. Some students use them. They're there if you need them. And you know, they can be a very valuable support for many students, but you can quite easily do an OU course without speaking to anybody apart from the other person in the kitchen or whatever. But for the rest of us, for the 5,000 staff based on those sites physically and used to coming into offices and or into labs, working in teams and what have you, that was a big change. Like, and that was similar to everybody else.
Right.
So not everybody not going into work on that Monday morning and trying to frantically setting up at home, wheeling chairs across campus so we didn't all get bad backs and and then trying to our first Skype and Zoom meetings. But I would have thought within a week we were 80% operational. In fact, we were probably 80% operational within a few days because everybody was doing what they needed to do. We set up an operational dashboard, had people reported in on how all the different units were doing, so we could, in a sense, come back together virtually, although we were distributed, and we've been doing that ever since.
Oh, well, I was imagining, right, you'd have a really big edge in this. It sounded like you have a bit of an edge in terms of the administrative setup. Online learning, etc., have been like that for years. That's, you know, I take that as given. But I'd assumed that in a kind of management sense, you were going to be miles ahead of the game. But it doesn't sound like you were, just a bit ahead of the game. And that's
well, I personally wasn't ahead of the game. Obviously, yeah. I'd never really paid any attention to things like Skype and I wanted a printer, obviously, at home. It was vital. How was I going to operate if I couldn't print off pages and pages of committee papers? And then finding myself bereft of a printer, and suddenly, you know, I'm Mr. Whiz on the computer.
So are you Mr. Whiz on the computer, or are you just pretending?
Well, the fact that we're talking to each other now, I think, is evidence.
Oh, right. Okay. Excellent. Well, it's real progress. Real progress, Dave. I'm impressed, as I'm sure your family and friends are as well. The what does that mean in terms of your reach? So, I mean, you, you've got a big span of control within the OE, spreading across all four home nations then, presumably. So you have staff in all of those four areas, do you?
The nations are, I don't know how I would describe them, and as they're not, and in case they're listening, they're fairly, there's a degree of autonomy that has to be, because they are working for their nations. So they've got very close links with the nation governments in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And so it is the OU in Scotland, the OU in Wales, the OU in Northern Ireland. And those teams of staff there with a director work very closely as a distinct and discrete unit. Having said that, of course, a lot of the operations, I mean, they have to be coordinated and work closely with staff across the nations and with Milton Keynes. So yes, most of the meetings that I have, there will be nation staff and faculty staff in those meetings. So make sure we're both joined up and cognizant of the different regulatory environments in which we're working. So we're trying to do both things. So yes, there's the staff spread around. Yes, they're working and dedicated to their nations, but yes, they're also having to work closely with each other and with Milton Keynes.
And how have you found coming into that environment, again, bearing in mind you only had 4 days office in the office and time to change your waste paper bin, right? The, you know, the traditional getting to know you, getting to know all about you thing when you do move to university, in your university, and you know, kind of spend a lot of time going around the department, all that kind of stuff. You presumably have had to do all that on screen then.
Yeah, I've only visited the site a couple of times since we've locked down, so I don't know the site very well, yeah. I must admit.
And the people.
And I'd met some colleagues before I started, which was invaluable in retrospect. However, of course, like other colleagues, there's many I've only ever met online. Maybe that's a good thing. Who knows?
Maybe they'll think you're really tall, do they?
Yes. Yeah, there is that. I've been saying that for a long time, and they think I've got a full head of hair, but that's the wig. But yeah, that's I look forward to meeting some of them in the flesh, and you know, hopefully the feeling's going to be mutual. But it is awkward. It's not the same, obviously. Yeah. Having said that, how often would I be meeting staff in the nations? You know, we've got to think about being sustainable travel, so you don't want to be flying up there all the time. So I think it's been what do we call it? It's been an equalizer, if you like.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's one of the great valuable things has been having meetings where everybody's equal. It's not the case that some people are in a room and, you know, sharing jokes with each other, and other people are beaming in on a big screen saying, sorry, what was that? Who's speaking next? And all this sort of stuff. It is, yeah. There's an equality about it, which I think has been very valuable for us as a four-nation university.
Yeah, Yeah, no, I can see that. So is there anything that's really surprised you about moving into your new role, or the shocking things that you want to say about the OU, or just, you know, things that you just didn't occur to you about, you know, the quirks of one organisation versus another, apart from the nomenclature, which you already identified, the jargon? Well, I can remember when I first moved to UEA, UEA was home with a three-letter acronym, and I found it utterly bamboozling, the number of acronyms people use. It's like they were hardwired to use acronyms all the time. And it took ages to get up to speed. You know, you got your crib sheet with all your acronyms and alphabetical order, and you still couldn't keep up, you know, because you had 18 schools, each with its own three-letter acronym, and trying to remember which school was which, I just, you know, it took so long. God knows how the students survived.
I suppose the maybe the differences are obvious. It's obviously a very large organization. We talked about the four nations. I was surprised it needed a hard-working team of landscape gardeners to maintain the campus for a distance learning or an online learning organization was a surprise. Having the 4,000 associate lecturers and meeting some of them, that's been a surprise. I didn't realize that and that the way they're contracted to the university is different. They're on individual contracts and they're not permanent employees, and that's a big project for us to deal with that, you know, so that's been something of a challenge. I suppose it is more similar than you'd think in other ways, like the governance of the institution. You'd recognize, you know, it's got a council and a senate and the subcommittees. It's Byzantine and
excellent,
you know, and
that obviously really at home.
Already, you know, I've turned my attention to the style of the agendas and all those things you just want to get a grip of that you can just waste your life on. But nevertheless, I'm wasting my life on it. But some of those things are very similar indeed. And there's a research operation at the OU. I knew a bit about that because the space activity, Les Thread Links. So I was aware there was some research. Well, and obviously there's the link with the BBC. It'd been interesting finding out about that and how we work there, and the huge volume of free online courses that we offer through Open Learn. So you're always finding out something new about the scale of the institution, and you know that's been really exciting, that side. Yeah.
I mean, it's also, I mean, it's a university that an awful lot of people who, like me, know nothing about it, have a bizarre sense of, you know, kind of both, you know, pride and nostalgia about it for no good reason other than it, you know, it feels like, you know, an actual product of a political time in the 60s when Britain was wildly optimistic about its future. And, you know, it kind of carries this weight of optimism about a national identity as well, and a different way of doing higher education, which, you know, is all very fluffy and vague and whatever. You've actually got to do stuff and make it happen, ensure it survives as an organization. But is the kind of legacy stuff, you know, real to people? I mean, does it carry it lightly, or is it something that, you know, drags the organization back, do you think?
It's a good question. It's really strong. The idea of the institution as a social mission is very, very strong in the university. And remembering where it's come from is very strong. Why it was set up, its commitment to openness, open to people, places. There's four things, and I need to remember them all, don't I? There's open to people, places, ideas, and other things that are important to be open to. So it is very much that, and it's living it. And that's the great appeal. And I suppose, to be fair, I hadn't quite realised that it would be as tangible in the institution. And that social commitment's very strong. I suppose if you were candid, you'd think there is a risk with it. I mean, Leicester had a strong sense of where it came from, being found after the First World War, and that sense of how it was found and the involvement with the Attenboroughs and things like that. But probably less than other parts of the sector, more exposed to the cold winds of competition and regulation. Certainly the changes to part-time fees and that a effect hit the OU hard. And that was probably a, whether that was known that the institution was going to be hit like that is a moot point. So I don't think it's been quite as exposed as some other parts of the sector who would similarly say, I'm sure at Nottingham you'd be saying, no, we've, you know, we've got a commitment to a region and community and and the impact of the research and the medical efforts and all that sort of thing. You'd be equally saying that. More tangible, I think, at the OU, definitely. And pros and cons because of that, mainly huge benefits. We are always thinking, how are we delivering for those who haven't had the opportunity to get into the mainstream sector? And I think it is a good question for the mainstream sector. We're taking students on an open basis with no without reference really to their prior education, broadly speaking, and then getting them through a degree program, which is got a quality framework, which is similar to any other university and with external examiners and all that sort of thing. So we are taking the students who either didn't get the chance or hadn't got the A-levels and got the educational background, if you like, and giving them the same higher educational opportunity. So you'd argue, well, it can be done.
But yeah, I know, I agree. And I think it is absolutely laudable. I one of the questions that, you know, I simply had no idea about the answer to, and you may not know it yet, is that I always assume that, you know, people who are enrolling on an OU degree are often, you know, it's often almost always part time. I think most of them are part. Is that right? Is that fair? Most of them are part time.
Yeah. So there's some. In one sense, they're all part time, but some of them are studying at full intensity.
Right. Yeah. But they're doing it in, you know, often with a, you know, full time job. You know, it's later in life. Yep. It's lots of other pressures and challenges, maybe financial, maybe domestic, whatever it might be. But they've got, you know, the odds are stacked against them for all sorts of reasons. Right. And this is their kind of big chance. And I think whereas as a privileged 18-year-old in a campus environment, you know, your time is yours to waste as well as focus on your studies, whereas actually these students that you have absolutely have to completely focus on getting through their course. Because of all these challenges, I imagine that you know people do drop out because of the challenges they face, not because they're not able to do the course. So I wonder, tell me to get stuffed if you want, but is there a sense in which actually that's the primary reason for dropout, just other circumstances? Or do you actually fail a lot of people because, you know, because of your open entry, it turns out that quite a few of them aren't actually capable of prosecuting a degree just because they, you know, it is genuinely beyond them? Or is it actually the fact that you know, the only people who do it are actually people who are capable of finishing it, but for, you know, circumstances conspire against them?
You're right, and the personal stories, if you like, of individuals is also another powerful narrative within the institution because of that diversity of experience and the challenge of maintaining the commitment to doing a degree while holding down a job, running a family, or whatever it is. However, having said that, the pressure from, or the expectation from OFS is the same as on other parts of the sector, that students, once they've started, it's our responsibility to support them to get through the programme. And I think generally speaking, and I do say this from a position of a huge degree of ignorance, as far as I understand it, on a very limited period spent at the OU, it is more to do with the experience of individuals and they simply can't do it. They can't cope intellectually, as opposed to the challenge of committing the time and life circumstances changing, you know, having children, moving house, losing your job, getting a job, all those other things that are living, of course. I was going to say interfere with life, but that is it.
That is life.
There is it. There's nothing else. Oh dear. So that is more likely to be the reason. But the challenge on us is to support the students through that.
Those
changes.
Absolutely. And long may you continue to do it. We touched a bit about the kind of challenges that the OU faced in terms of, you know, kind of part-time funding, etc. I mean, leaving aside the specifics of the OU, the whole sector has been facing funding issues now in all sorts of different ways, and faces a very uncertain future. In thinking about, you know, as you've had the opportunity to do while you've been drifting into your new role, you know, casting your, you know, cynical eye over the sector and the, you know, the way that the, you know, the government and the Department for Education and Secretary of State and ministers is looking at our sector. What's your big question time, right? Big question. I mean, what's your thinking about the way things are going to pan out over the next few years for higher education? Are we going to move away from the Higher Education Research Act, the kind of marketized agenda, to something very, very different, which is a much more kind of, you know, socially rooted idea of higher education in its community, a kind of different social mission? Or is this just a kind of temporary blip on the way to, you know, further marketization and consumerism in higher education? What's your thinking been about the future of our sector in 30 seconds?
I thought there should be a suitably long pause there to show that I was giving it some thought. That's a good question. I'm glad you asked it, mate. Honestly, I was really quite prepared for it. I've always taken this view of higher education, which stretches back, as you know, about 800 years. And if you take that sort of perspective, this is a blip. I don't know. I mean that seriously, in the sense that there's the tension around our education and universities is always between the utilitarian view of education or the education as an end in itself, education as a right, education as an economic benefit, and those tensions are, you know, that debate trundles on and it shifts one way or the other. I would suggest that if I was looking back in 10 or 20 years, providing I'm not dead and I'm able to do that, then I would probably be interpreting this time as when there was a challenge to marketization. Yeah, it was challenged in the way that school education has been challenged by the drive of league tables and what have you. And you kind of exposed the flaws in assessment procedures and what have you. So that's been exposed. Whether you know this government will particularly respond to that or do anything about it or carry on with the view that market approach is the best way of ensuring an appropriately educated workforce, which is I guess one way of looking at it, as opposed to a community which has been given education as a tool in which to live a better life, which is more the bias I would have. I would have thought they'll carry on with the market, and this is a blip in that sense, but a blip only in the fact that argument or that debate continues with societal events biasing one perspective over the other. If that makes sense, I'd be very happy.
And so that's gonna happen over the next 800 years.
Yes, that's just, well, I was thinking looking back in 10 years, that's what I think we'd see. I mean, it does worry me. That some of the languages again has come to the fore that we've seen in the past, that the very utilitarian purpose of education, and the belief that there's only certain types of degrees that are worthwhile. They have to be applied to your economic role in society, and that has to be determined by how much money you earn. I mean, that to me is the wrong way of looking at life. It just is wrong. It's the wrong way for governments to think about communities. There's so many things wrong with it, you know, and I'm sure other middle class liberals will feel exactly the same as I do as being part of that particular grouping.
Speaking for middle class liberals everywhere, who I'm sure will be responding warmly to your comments, I think what they would say is that the challenge is then converting that into actual practice, because we do have a quite fragmented sector in terms of its ability to present a coherent face in response to any particular government challenge. And of course, at the moment, we are all absorbed with responding to the pandemic in ways which, make longer term thinking, I think, quite difficult. So we are all in kind of reactive mode at the moment. So I think your point about it being a blip is probably true. But then, you know, the challenge for all of us is how we kind of seize control of a higher education agenda in a few years' time when things do get back to something resembling normality, and actually try and map out a collective future for higher education, which universities themselves are seeking to shape and involving their communities as well as, you know, the wider public. Because I mean, I think, you know, government has shifted from a point of view of kicking universities, the media as well, to lauding us for our involvement in seeking, you know, cures for the virus and you know, responding to the challenges, etc., etc. And all of our nurses and doctors going into hospitals, all that kind of stuff has been really lovely. But we'll start being kicked again before too long.
That's a good point, actually.
And then we're going to have to, you know, come up with a compelling narrative about the importance of higher education for not just economic but social cohesion as well, in a country which is going to look very, very different, you know, post Brexit, post pandemic.
Yeah, I'd almost forgotten that before the pandemic, when I was giving presentations, that you'd put up a slide showing the constant criticisms of the sector, the headlines of everything was wrong, you know, they were just the terrible organisations doing terrible things. And we were getting a good kick in. And to be fair, there were some issues where we are challenged. When you think about decolonisation of curriculum and sexual violence on campus, you know, there are some issues where I think some of it was fair comment about us getting a grip of them. Having said that, it's looking to universities like you, like Nottingham, where you were handing kit out, you know, helping with resolving or mitigating the issues of COVID very early on, and the solutions that the clinical solutions will be found in the labs of universities with university staff. So that's but then governments, I suppose, have always had this kind of Janus-like view of universities. On the one hand, you know, we're liberal clubs that have no interest in anything other than wandering around the quad with their hands behind their back thinking thoughts, as opposed to actually engaging with the problems of society, on the one hand. And then, you know, the next minute we're a bunch of lefty Marxists kind of trying to distort the education system and so we can grow a load of mini Che Guevaras or something. You know, there are bizarre parodies almost that are believed in governments of similar of different types, rather. So there is one thing that does concern me when I'm talking about, you know, politics and class and universities, and that is what we've got to be careful of is that in the context of COVID and staff returning to work and the tensions around that, and seeing the same tension in society between, you know, whether it's the right or the wrong thing to be going back to work and socializing, whether we should be concerned about the economy or our health, which I think is an entirely false dichotomy, but that what we don't end up is that we say, yeah, it's okay for the lower paid staff, they can all go back on the campus and start sorting it out and make it ready for us, and all the rest of us who are better paid, we can all sit at home and enjoy our nice gardens and everything. I do worry a bit that some of the resistance to return to work has got that risks having a nasty underbelly to it. You know, if you've got staff on campus, I want to be on campus. And I think there's a dangerous divide occurring between those who are sent to serve us, to deliver our goods and to run our pubs and everything, while the rest of us can sit safely in our nice suburbia.
And I think I've, you know, seen an element of that play out as well. It's undoubtedly part of the picture at the moment. Dave, let's leave it there, but it's been great to catch up after all this time and to learn about your new role and to talk about the future, the next 800 years of higher education.
Thanks very much, Paul. It's good to see you, because you look a lot younger online. I mean, honestly, that hat You know, you couldn't. You look like Tom Baker from Doctor Who.
readers, I don't. Until next time, Dave, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Paul. Cheers.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course, and if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until next time.